This program was first broadcast on Canterbury's access media station, Plains FM, and was made with the assistance of New Zealand On Air.
Hello and welcome to 3-3-1-Cast. This podcast is your pit stop for a comedic but educational take on the crazy and illustrious world of Formula One.
We will take you through the latest news and happenings, while also offering our views and perspectives on the key moments, both on and off the track. So, to quote the great David Croft of Sky Sports F1,
it's lights out and away we go.
Hello and welcome back to another episode of 3-3-1-Cast. You're joined by all three of us again in the studio. Stephen, you made it here just in the nick of time.
Yeah, it's been a busy day at work for me, but I'm pleased to be here to talk all about the Austrian Grand Prix.
We do have Josh.
We are having a little technical difficulty.
I do not have my headphones on at the moment, but that should not be an issue.
You sound pretty good to me, Josh.
So good. You can crack on crystal clear.
Yeah,
good.
I mean, look, it was an exciting Grand Prix this weekend. Austria, it was the home race for Red Bull, who are currently leading the constructors' standings. It ultimately wasn't a result they will be too happy with, that we'll get into that later on. So like I said, Red Bull currently winning the constructors' championship, followed closely, well, semi-closely by Ferrari. There's about a 55-point difference on them. And then Mercedes, who are just consistently hitting points. And interestingly, I'm only going to rattle off the top five, but McLaren and Alpine joint on 81 points. So
I hadn't actually realised that.
We have a bit of a race to battle off the fourth.
Finally McLaren showed some capabilities this race. It's not just going to be handed to them.
It was not a good race for McLaren. I didn't think.
Well, they had a double points finish, maybe the bar's been set so low that a double points finish to me is a good result for McLaren.
I think that's it.
The way they were in qualifying, I mean, the comment is still sticking with me from Lando Norris in qualifying when he said he was afraid to touch the brake pedal because the car was so, I don't know, it just wasn't quite working for him. Yeah, it was, and he kept going off in qualifying as well. And sure, maybe they got those issues fixed in the race, but it was just a concerning comment that sort of stuck with me.
You don't want to have no confidence in your race car, especially when it comes to braking, right?
And Danny Ric out in Q1 as well. I mean,
That was kind of continuing on from his performance last week, which we did forget to mention that Ricciardo came 13th with 6 DNFs behind him.
It's like deja vu talking about this for him. I don't know if anything's ever going to change.
Mm. I was talking to someone about it today with Daniel Ricciardo. You know, he's obviously struggled since he's went to McLaren, and I wonder if when he first got there and he was struggling, if he still sort of had that stardom about him that, you know, he was kind of still in his heyday but didn't have a car that he suited, and now he's almost past his heyday and he's still in a car that doesn't suit him. Mm. And it's just that compounding effect because he's really not lived up to the expectations that all the fans wanted to see when he joined.
Not at all. And he's on a pretty big salary to boot, so it's
yeah, that's true. I mean, I don't know. I think we'll get into this later a little bit, but, you know, I would love to see Vettel replace him at McLaren.
Oh, could be more deserving.
Bold choice.
Well, because, you know, I think Vettel and Ricciardo are similar-esque in the set. I mean, I think Vettel's different class by his history.
But they're both super hyped up and have had peak times in the past. So, yeah, they kind of have some similarities.
I just wonder if Vettel is too old for a shot with McLaren.
I just reckon he complements Lando and is that experience head, which is probably what they were after in Daniel. I mean, obviously, Seb's a bit older, but I just wonder, it's like almost like a switch one out for the other kind of ordeal.
Yeah, potentially. I mean, if I was McLaren, the driver I'd have my eye on, and we mentioned it the other week, Pierre Gasly. I mean, no path to the Red Bull seat at the moment. Like,
well, how do you think he did this race, guys? I mean, he kind of had another just not very interesting race.
Yeah, he was quiet until he then tailed out Seb.
Yeah, that's all I saw from him.
And actually, the last couple races, I wouldn't say not only has he sort of not obviously been further up the field in the results, but he's just been so quiet. Like, none of the sort of epic overtakes and some of the feisty driving that we saw last season. What do you think, Steve?
Certainly that stardom that seemed to follow him in 2020 and 2021 hasn't really been there this year. And I remember the commentators on Sky F1 mentioned, I think it was a couple of races ago, about how he just, yeah, doesn't seem to have be as one with the car this year in comparison to other years.
Do you think that could be down to, because that sort of Red Bull seat is so unattainable right now, at least for the foreseeable future, do you think there's just a drain on his sort of motivation? Because last year, you could argue that Sergio Perez was unproven in a Red Bull, and as much as everyone likes Sergio Perez and thinks he's a good driver, people are still looking at Gasly as like, this guy is like potentially really, really good. So do you think he's just been drained on motivation?
Yeah, that could be part of it to explain. I'd be very interested if we ever got the chance to speak to a driver face-to-face. I mean, right now, that's the question I'd be asking him. Is your pace down, you know, or are you lacking pace because you're lacking motivation because that top seat isn't attainable at the moment?
Mm. Well, I mean, on that topic, is Tsunoda still ahead of Gasly in the standings?
In the Austria Grand Prix, he finished, Tsunoda finished just behind Gasly, but I'll just pull up the current standings.
I think while Rory's doing that, I mean, Tsunoda, on the subject of him, I think he's going to be under a lot of pressure to keep his seat for 2023.
Yeah, this is his second year, right?
Second year in F1, and I feel like Tsunoda hasn't been bad, but he also hasn't been standout, star, amazing, and to me that's what Red Bull is looking for in that car. And
I think as well, Tsunoda, I picked up on a comment or a video, I can't remember which, where they were saying they've actually hired a psychologist for Yuki Tsunoda, because when he's making a mistake mid-corner, he's freaking out in the car and he's not keeping composed, and he's essentially losing further time doing that. So they're clearly looking at him going, this guy is already so loose in his mind when it comes to, you know, trying to get as much speed as possible, and he's letting them down there. I don't foresee how somebody of his nature that's needing to have a whole psychologist hired, that how would they be looking at him going, oh yeah, future Red Bull driver, yeah.
Sounds to me like they see a lot of talent, but there's some kind of personality flaw, some kind of attitude that needs to be overcome, and and they're giving him a chance to overcome that. But like you say, that you can't have years and years to do that because it's such a competitive world.
Did you see in the Drive to Survive where he had his personal trainer, it went to Yuki's home and they were showing his training, and he was just like, I don't want to train. I hate training. I can't be bothered. Mm-hmm. And the guy had to convince him to go for a small run. Like, come on. The Christian Horner's not looking at that going, oh man, I can't wait for that guy to be in my number one seat.
Yeah, yeah.
But
yeah,
no, to answer your question, Pierre Gasly is ahead of Yuki Tsunoda. So Gasly is in 13th with 16 points, and Tsunoda's in 16th with 11 points.
Right.
Do you want 16 points, though, for Gasly. That's not many.
Nope. No.
Yeah.
Well, while you're looking at that, Rory, do you want to fire off on some of the other standings?
Yeah, so Max is still leading, 208 points, and Charles Leclerc has obviously closed the gap by a bit. So Charles Leclerc now has 170 points. So potentially, let's say, hypothetically, if Max got two DNFs in the next two races and Charles Leclerc won both, then he'd be in the lead.
Mm. Right.
So
I don't think that gap is actually that, because what was Verstappen on again, sorry?
208.
208. So the gap is what, 38
48.
Points?
Yeah.
48?
38.
Oh, sorry, 38
points.
Yeah.
38 points. So
that's not
huge, but with the way that we've seen reliability, you know, it's affected both Ferrari and Max. Max retired in Australia and Bahrain, the season opener. There's two DNFs. And Charles retired from the lead in both Spain and Azerbaijan.
Yeah.
You know, if we're going to keep seeing more of this, especially as it gets to the end of the season when components are getting to the end and they're, you know, trying not to get grid penalties, I mean, I think 38 points is not in, you know, is not all sealed and sent for Verstappen sort of thing.
Okay.
As you were sort of
alluding
to. Let
me put this to you, though. The gap between Charles Leclerc and Max Verstappen is bigger than the gap between Charles Leclerc and Sergio Perez and Carlos Sainz.
Mm.
Yes.
So
interesting stat.
It's, you kind of have to, like, you've made a great point, you know, the reliability issues have been on both Red Bull and Ferrari, probably more so Ferrari.
Mm.
But ultimately, yes, he's not out of it, but also he's going to have to be defending quite hard from Perez and Sainz behind him, because they're hanging around.
Yeah, you know? Well, I guess he has the advantage that I think Ferrari will choose to prioritise Leclerc if they can, arguably they didn't do that in the British Grand Prix, but
they seem to be letting them race so much. Like,
yeah, well,
everyone thought, yeah, Leclerc will be number one at the moment, but they've just let each other race.
But Leclerc definitely has that number one feel about things, right? Like, he's quicker than Sainz on raw pace. I don't think anyone would disagree with that.
No.
He has one up on Sainz. And an interesting thing, actually, just going back to the points, is I'm pretty sure this is right. You'll find that the difference between Perez and Sainz is exactly 18 points. And so had Sainz not retired in Austria with that spectacular fiery engine blow up,
That's
he would have drawn level with Perez on points.
Oh, wow.
Yes, but Perez also had to DNF as well.
Yeah, Perez DNF from that race as well. So effectively nothing changed between them. But, it shows you what Ferrari lost.
Well, shows you that it's all about one retirement at this point, and it's still anyone's.
And that's the thing, right? Reliability can play a huge role in the in the points race.
And still, we see that Mercedes are proving to be the most reliable.
Being
able to snatch a 3 and 4 in this race.
Yeah.
With the performance.
Was it 3 and 4?
Yep. I've got it right.
I'm thinking that. I hadn't quite realised. Because Russell did get that 5 second penalty, which is what let Hamilton get ahead of him though for the podium.
Interesting. Didn't realise that.
Yeah, because Russell got the penalty for colliding with Perez on that first lap.
Of course.
Which put Perez out the race. So.
Yeah. What do you guys think of that collision? Because does it have similarities?
The Perez Russell one.
We've seen that accident at that corner. So many times, it always happens.
We saw it twice in this race.
Yeah, because we saw it later. Vettel got hit off by someone.
Gasly
and Vettel.
And in that one, it seems pretty clear that Gasly was in the wrong.
Yeah,
you know,
it's the same thing. The guy on the outside, just the way the corner's constructed, the guy on the inside always kind of drifts a bit too far.
Because it's such a tight corner that it's impossible to stay right along the inside.
George's excuse for it was that he couldn't stay on the apex because he was already on the edge of the grip at which he had. So his sort of argument was, if I turn the wheel anymore, I was going off, so I was trying to keep it in, and Checo was too close to me, so I bumped him. But
around the outside, that's the thing, they carry the more momentum, and so they, although they're sort of behind at the apex, then they shoot round on the exit, and they don't get around quick enough, and the front, you know, the front left hits the rear right and spins that guy around.
Yeah.
And we saw it. I think it was in 2020 with Alex Albon and Lewis Hamilton, the same sort of accident at that corner. That's the accident that corner causes.
Well, so the lesson should be for the future drivers, stay on the inside. Get off better.
Well, but you get the penalty if you're on the inside.
But you're not out of the race.
You're not out of the race. That's the thing, yeah.
Yeah.
I think the real message is do not go around the outside there.
But then, I mean, there are other parts of the race where you can go around the outside. I mean, I saw that Hamilton did a really good overtake on someone around the outside. Who was that? Was that one of the Haases?
Turn 8. It was on Schumacher.
Was that in the sprint race?
No, that was in the race.
Was it in the race?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Those two did have an amazing battle in the sprint
race. I was just going to say, let's pause for a minute and throw some respect on Mick Schumacher's name, because we sat here not probably 3 weeks ago in this studio saying, wow, it's becoming a bit of a hype train, and he's not got any points.
And the pressure's on him.
He's got to do something sometime soon. And he obviously didn't hear that, but it's like he did, because now he went and he had a fantastic performance. Just missed out on points in the sprint. Obviously got points last weekend at Silverstone, and picked up points this weekend.
And his best finish by far, P6.
Yeah. Amazing.
Do you guys think he can do any better than P6 in a Haas? I mean, like,
yes,
it's possible.
And I will say yes on the circumstance of this race, because I reckon, you know, Ocon was just in front of him. I think Haas on a good day have more pace than an Alpine.
So cool to hear.
I think, unfortunately, my view is that Haas only get it together for a good day once a season. You know,
that's not true. They've had a few good days already.
They had
season.
A good day. Like, certainly for Mick as a driver, him in the last two races has been phenomenal.
Yeah.
And when you consider that he's probably fighting for his seat next year, these are the sort of performances that he needs to be putting in to keep it.
Facts, yeah.
Certainly, I would have said, if I was Gunther Steiner at Haas before the British Grand Prix, I would be looking for another driver for that seat. You know, I think he'd given Mick a run, and Mick had done well, but sort of like Tsunoda in a way. He hadn't done badly, but he hadn't also hadn't set the world alight, and it's probably not the right wording, but you know, he hadn't done anything spectacular. Whereas these last two races have been that, and now I think the key for him is continuing that and not slipping back into what Haas have been sort of at the other points.
Yeah, I mean, if he can keep also outperforming Magnussen, that says a lot. Yeah. As well.
I think the key for him will be points finishes.
Okay.
Even if he's driving well, even if he's finishing 11th or 12th and driving well, it's not going to make the headlines like finishing 7th and 8th, you know, in coming races will, or even higher, you know.
Yeah. But I think
Rory is right.
His confidence seems to, you know, if you look at what's changed in the last three races from being from never getting any points to now have winning points on two Formula One races back to back, I think the only thing that's changed is that first race where he got points, and maybe it's a confidence thing. So maybe it's floodgates are open, he's going to race harder now, because even in the sprint race, like you guys were saying, that duel with Hamilton was so cool. Mm. Yeah.
And I think you've got to wonder about how much confidence plays a role for these drivers, and the reason I say that is because we saw Perez win the race in Monaco, arguably through the, you know, did it in the strategy of the race and came out on top. Huge confidence boost to get your first win of the season at Monaco. Comes to Azerbaijan the next week and puts it on pole ahead of Max Verstappen. Mm-hmm. We've now seen Carlos Sainz get his first win in the British Grand Prix. And look at him in the sprint race in Austria. He was challenging Leclerc. Yeah. They were racing those two.
True. And I don't think
we've seen that between Ferrari this season. And now look at Mick, for example, gets his first points in Britain and then comes to Austria and puts in arguably his best driver of his career the week after.
So your point is, it's very much a mental sport.
I just wonder how much, in all three of those examples that I've just listed, how much confidence has played a factor in the performances afterwards.
It must be huge, eh? Yeah. Like, because let's not beat around the bush. They are literally driving the fastest road-going machines on the planet around some of the hardest tracks in the world. Like, not only do you have to be a bit of a maniac to sign yourself up, you have to be incredibly talented, and I think that in there has to be that concoction of confidence and self-belief.
And that's where someone like maybe Alex Albon just went wrong. He lost confidence as the season went on with some unlucky crashes.
That's such a good point, because if you look at it on the flip side, there are so many drivers, don't ask me to name them because I'll forget, but there are so many drivers over the years that have just suddenly dipped in form, and you just look at it and you just see that they're lacking
confidence. It's on a
confidence.
Bad streak.
Like, Ricciardo could be hugely down to that. Obviously, driver style is a thing, but...
Well, because if he gets a couple crashes, it's going to be like, he's probably trying to avoid crashing because that will be the final straw.
Yeah.
So he's driving safely,
and
slowly.
If your brain's thinking about that, it's not thinking about taking that next corner as quickly as humanly possible, is it?
No.
Plus,
for Ricciardo, it must be that mental drain of just week after week not getting what he wants out of the car. You know, to stay 100% positive, the same as you would be if you were scoring podiums every week, is almost impossible.
And they have to face up to, first of all, the media after every race. They have to try and say something even if they are just something positive. And I mean, and then they have to face to their team principal and all the people in the pit. Yeah, that's got to be draining.
It's almost like you're back at school, you know, when you've had like a really bad day or bad test, and the teacher's like, okay, but tell me something positive, and they're like, oh god, I don't know,
nothing.
It was nice scenery or something.
It's
pretty rough for them.
So
other than that, Hamilton, it's good to see three people on the podium from different teams. That's like we were saying, you know, having top three teams and six cars all fighting for the podium. And though in saying that, Sainz probably would have, there probably would never have been a podium for Mercedes if Sainz hadn't had that.
Absolutely. I think Ferrari were on for a 1-2 finish.
Yeah. And it was quite late in the race, later than I thought. 57, it looked.
Was it lap
57 out of 71?
Sort of in that second half of the race. And all, like, Sainz hadn't overtaken Verstappen yet, but he, I mean, with the strategy that Ferrari played, he was bound to. But who knows? It could have been an interesting fight between them, but I think Sainz, was likely to overtake him and finish second.
Stephen, is now the time we should debate the whole Marshalls situation around Sainz's fire?
Do you want me to sort of outline, I guess, for anyone who didn't see what happened? Obviously, Sainz had an engine failure in the Austrian Grand Prix. It was a pretty spectacular failure. There was a lot of fire, a lot more than we usually see. And Sainz had to pull off into a kind of into the runoff area, but uphill. And so, as you guys would have seen on the coverage, they were showing him getting out, and then they saw the fire, and he was trying to get the car stopped, but these cars don't have handbrakes, so you can't just pull the handbrake and get it stopped on a hill. So you could see what Science was trying to do, where he's trying to jump out of the car, but as soon as he takes his foot off the brake, the car starts rolling backwards, which would have been a really scary feeling for him as he's trying to then get out of the car. The car's getting on fire. It was pretty stressful, and like I said to you, Rory, they actually ended up cutting away from it, probably because they realised actually this could go bad really quickly and we might be witnessing something quite untoward. But fortunately, Science got out all okay. But
it was kind of one of those things where if he jumped out of the car, a big fireball was going to reverse onto the track and obviously cause a lot of destruction, or he had to sit in there, keep his foot on the brake and be engulfed by flames. So either way, he was in a pretty bad situation.
Yeah, I hadn't actually thought about that, about the car rolling all the way back towards the track.
Yeah, literally, his exit road was just off the corner. So
yeah, but he was still 100 metres into the...
I reckon it would have rolled onto the track. Like, I think it was a pretty scary situation.
Did you see, I only saw this in afterwards, that the marshal who came out eventually, and this is, I guess, what we're about to debate.
Keyword is eventually.
Though. Yeah. The marshal who came out tried to put a wedge under the wheel to try and stop
pretty
it.
Pretty brave.
Pretty brave.
Yeah, but I mean, that thing's moving and all this stuff.
Yeah, like, and they're not light things. That thing could
crush
roll
your foot
onto you. Yeah, exactly.
Oh, see.
But anyway, so don't you set up the debate?
Yeah, my point of view is, we shouldn't be amazed at the fact that a marshal ran onto chock a wheel like that. I think firstly the response was very slow, and actually there's a really good video online. If you search sort of Carlos Sainz engine fire, you'll see that a couple marshals begin running towards the car with fire extinguishers. One of them stops, puts his fire extinguisher down, then turns and walks away, whereas the other guy goes from running and begins sort of walking and taking his time, whereas this is when the whole Science with the car reversing, he can't get out, the fire's growing really rapidly. So it just looks odd. As a spectacle, it looks weird, like a weird response. And then they've got one little slab of wood thing that they're trying to chock on the wheel and stop the car from rolling back. And you would think, if you have an exit road that's on a hill and your marshals are there, they need to be well prepared that a car is going to come up there, potentially in that condition of being in a fire. Or even if it's not even on fire, they still don't want to have how much do they weigh, like 700 kilogram race car rolling down the hill with them trying to push it up the hill. That doesn't make sense. So the fact they had a small block of wood and they were slow getting there, and one of the marshals even bailed out on running with his fire extinguisher, it just looked weird, and I think they were underprepared, and that should hopefully start sparking more questions about racetracks that have hills and exit roads like what we have at Austria. They need to be better prepared and they need to be quicker, because to me, Science was literally in a decision of, I'm being engulfed by flames, because by the time he left the car, flames were lapping his body. I either bail out of this car and it rolls away and I know that the racetrack's behind me and I might be fine, or I stay in here and fire continues to engulf me. So I was just really perplexed by the response.
Yeah, I think the reason though that the marshals took so long to get onto the track is because you can't put marshals onto track that is not got a safety car or a virtual safety car on it.
Yeah.
And that's not to fully make your point moot. It's to say, I guess, that to me, the responsibility should have been on the safety car being thrown quicker.
Right.
Red flags.
Yeah, okay, yeah. They threw
a virtual safety car eventually. But the problem, and this is what I bring it all the way back to, is if you've got marshals on track when there are double-waved yellow flags, which is what they had, double-waved yellow flags mean slow down and be prepared to stop for a driver. But a driver is the one who determines the risk in that situation. They are the ones who set the speed limit, decide how fast they're going to go. And these drivers are being paid to drive a car around the track as fast as they can. So
also, it's in their interest to keep tyres warm and keep airspeed. Like,
the driver who slows down the most is the one who loses the most, okay? And to me, that's always a risk. That's a corner where they're braking downhill. We've seen people lock the brakes there and go straight on. And the risk you run is someone, you know, it's not so much of a problem in dry conditions, but it's more the principle to me that if someone went into a double-waved yellow flag zone and they overestimated the risk and came in a bit too hot, they locked the brakes, and suddenly they're in the gravel trap and they're travelling towards a car. Sure, it's already on fire, but if you've got a marshal there and that you know, that can be a, that could be a situation where serious harm comes to a marshal.
Yeah.
And so I'm sort of the view that they should wait until the virtual safety car or the safety car is out, because at that point there's nothing to gain from the drivers going faster than one another because they're under a controlled speed limit.
Yeah.
So that's sort of my view of it, that the problem with that accident to me was how long it took for the virtual safety car to come out.
So maybe that was the causing factor behind the slow response.
Absolutely. But then I guess the other point to make is that such a spectacular, fiery, I don't know, spectacular is probably not the right word.
It was quite. You know, it was me and Josh were looking at it before. The literally, you could see the explosions happening through the sort of
certainly the amount of fire and the speed at which the fire engulfed the rear of the car was something to me that was quite quite unexpected. Not something we see very often.
Yeah, that's true.
I guess that would be the only caveat, that I think the scenario was one that wasn't
a double yellow. Because it sounds to me like there's never a scenario where a double yellow is good.
A double yellow is for when it's slowed down to be prepared to stop. It would be like if someone had spun off into the gravel, but their car's still running, their car's still okay, they've just made a mistake and spun off.
Oh.
That's where you need to be slowed down, because, you know, if you come hurtling in there at race speed and you make the same mistake, then you're going to have a crash.
But what you're saying is it's so arbitrary because the racer doesn't, well, doesn't have to slow down, or is it like if obey the double yellow?
Yeah, there are drivers who have been penalised before for going too fast under double waved yellows, but the essentially the risk is left, the risk of how much you back off, it's fully up to the driver to decide. Whereas with a virtual safety car, they have to slow down to a set limit, and so the risk is eliminated.
Yeah. So any time that anyone has to come onto a track or there's a driver still on the track, it should be a virtual safety car.
Yeah. To me, if there's marshals on track, if a car's stopped and a driver's getting out or something, to me that should be a virtual safety car.
Yeah.
But I imagine, like, in the case of, or it might have been different with signs, but in the case of, like, if a driver's just had an engine failure and there's no immediate risk, I'm pretty sure that they'd be waiting for their team to tell them before they can get out of the car. Because if you're sitting in a Formula One car with all your belts on and everything and someone crashes into you, you're probably going to be okay.
Yeah.
If you're standing next to it,
you're gone.
On the other hand, you're not.
Yeah.
So,
because didn't we have that really shocking incident numerous years ago now where a marshal was killed because pretty much that happened, right? Didn't somebody fly?
Well, the whole reason, I think you're probably thinking of what happened in Japan, which that didn't quite happen, but it's similar. The whole reason we have the virtual safety car is because when Zhou Bianchi crashed in Japan 2014 and lost his life in that crash,
he was under a double yellow.
It was because they had double waved yellows out for a crashed car, and they brought a recovery vehicle on to lift the car up to get the car out.
Oh, and he hit the recovery vehicle.
Jules Bianchi hit the recovery vehicle.
We have covered this one before, so let's not go too into detail on it.
But that's why the virtual safety car was created.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Okay, well, any final thoughts on the Austrian Grand Prix before we end?
Yeah, just one final point to me. I mean, obviously, we've sort of covered the outcome of it. Leclerc won. It's hosted up the championship even more. Some good middle pack racing. We had those five cars competing at one point, which was really exciting, so definitely recommend go back and watch that if you haven't. And we had three of the best drivers on the grid get DNF'd, so Sainz, Perez and Latifi. So we'll just move on from Austria, I think.
We'll
prepare for France coming up.
I think just one more, can I make one more point?
You may.
Oh, great. One more point on Austria was around, just to me, just how costly it was for Ferrari to lose Carlos Sainz late in that race. If he had finished, so they scored, because Leclerc won, they scored 25 points. Had Sainz finished second, that would have pushed Verstappen down to third. So Verstappen only scores 15 points, Perez is out. So, and with Sainz finishing second, Ferrari would have scored 43 points.
Jeez.
Red Bull would have scored 15. And so
massive.
The difference between them now is 56 points in the constructors.
Yeah.
Red Bull leads Ferrari by 56 points. Had Verstappen finished third, Sainz second, Leclerc won, the gap would have been just 35 points. And to me, that's a, you know, that's a big
that's
difference. That's something that could come back to bite Ferrari, I wonder.
Yeah, all we can say is thank goodness Leclerc managed to get past the line with no issues.
Oh, yeah. I mean, how nervous were you guys? Oh. My goodness.
Well, I mean, I've seen like this meme where you know how you have like the in your car, you have engine light, you have wiper fluid light, like his thing, everything was just flashing.
And he's just freaking out crossing the line. That's so
That would have, I think that would have been Ferrari's season over, to be honest, if...
If
right there
also,
and then Leclerc retired
and Max goes and wins.
Verstappen won.
Yeah.
25 points to Verstappen, no points for Leclerc off Sainz.
Very good.
Would have been,
very good.
That would have been the third race in 11 races that Leclerc would have retired from the lead. But thankfully that didn't happen for Ferrari.
Yeah. Okay, well, we'll move along. And I've got a one-off segment that I could fire straight into.
Absolutely,
let's hear it.
Guys. I mean, so... I watched the McLaren movie a couple weeks ago.
Was that Bill McLaren or Bruce McLaren?
Bruce McLaren, and I'm 100%. No, I'm a big fan of him now after this movie.
I'm pleased you finally remembered
his name
correctly.
Have you watched it?
I did watch it when it first came out, because it's a few years old.
2017
now,
or something.
Yeah, I remember I went and watched it when it first came out, but haven't seen it since.
Yeah, it definitely shows like the Kiwiana vibe that he had. He was such a Kiwi bloke. Really got into everything, the engineering. He was really good friends with everyone in the team. He was just working so hard all the time. And, I mean, so I have a few notes here. And if there's any responses, cool. Otherwise, I'll just fire on to the next one. They're not all that.
And FYI, I haven't seen this, and I'm planning to watch it. So you've got a noob in me, so I'm happy to be educated.
Cool. Yeah, it's not like, you know, I'm spoiling too much with this movie.
No, I mean, think it's fairly predictable. But let's do it.
So the first thing which was interesting was that Bruce McLaren was bound to a portable bed for 2 years in his childhood because of a disease that affected his pelvis.
Oh.
He never left this bed for 2 years.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. Like, right? He was wheeled around in this
bed. That could have been a beat the boss, you know.
Oh, I would have beat you.
Which driver was bound to their bed for 2 years of their life? My God.
Yeah, no, he had a kind of part of his pelvis, the leg that just was hanging off, so they strapped it in, but
hanging
it had to stay there. Yeah, well, slightly like loose in the socket.
Oh, right. Okay.
Yeah,
sorry,
not hanging
fully
off.
I thought, like, exterior. I was like, wow.
Hanging by three.
Yeah, no, so good on him to, like, you know, maybe being in that bed for 2 years was like, I want to go fast because I've been going slow for two years. The other thing I didn't know was that there was a New Zealand Grand Prix back in the day, New Zealand International Grand Prix.
Wasn't that in Hamilton?
I actually don't know. So there was more opportunities in New Zealand back then for getting into motorsport, and there was actually a scholarship that McLaren got to go to England and get into a team. Looks like the McLaren orange was the OG colour. I found that interesting, was that the first McLaren cars were orange like
did
that.
Did you not know that?
No.
Oh, okay,
well, because the famous ones from like Rush and all of that were red and white because of the cigarette Marlboro brand, right?
Yeah. So the red and white is sort of the more, is the more the newer era of McLaren as it was then, where it's sort of, because Bruce McLaren had died by that point, and so the team had, I don't want to say sold, but it had new people running it.
Yeah.
And it was a new team, so it was red and white. But yeah, the orange is the original, and McLaren, current McLaren, brought it back in 2017.
Yeah.
And it was, they initially got it wrong, like the colour was a little bit wrong. People didn't like it, but they got it right for 2018.
I'm a big fan of them going back to their roots, because I think that's the main takeaway I have, is just I'm gutted that Bruce McLaren, and we did talk about this, never got to see his team go to where it did, and he'd probably have no idea that it would survive to this day.
I'm fairly sure, I could be wrong, but I'm fairly sure that Ron Dennis, who used to run McLaren when they were really successful back in the sort of like the 80s, 90s and 2000s, he was always like dead set against the orange, because he kind of felt that it had to be a new team, like a new idea. I could be wrong on that, but I know that he was definitely not, you know, pro the orange.
Well, I mean, like, Ferrari always kept the red. Is that fair to say?
Well, yeah, Ferrari red. Yeah. Absolutely, yeah.
So, the other thing, McLaren is the last guy, Bruce McLaren is the last guy to win a race with his name on the car. And only two people have done it. So, him and the guy before him, who I'm not too sure
Jordan
about.
Jordan?
Do you know? Eddie Jordan was a team owner. Just the driver.
Yeah, so Bruce McLaren finished a Grand Prix in a McLaren, and that's the last time it's ever been done.
Wow, that's a cool claim to fame.
Win a Grand Prix or finish a Grand Prix?
Win a Grand Prix. Yeah. Oh, okay. It's the last guy to win a race.
So did he win an F1 race in a McLaren
car? Yeah, he did, which I'm happy about.
I watched it.
Yeah,
I mean, you watched the
and
film.
And it said he is the last guy to win a race.
Oh, no, I'm pretty sure, because I did a history of McLaren on this show not a few weeks ago, and I remember he did win a Formula 1 car, so that makes sense.
If we don't post anything to the Instagram denying this fact, just assume it's true. If you check the Instagram, we'll fact check this one for you guys.
Cheeky plug.
Yeah, exactly, cheeky. So after Ferrari, McLaren is the longest running and most successful F1 team. That's just a fact for you. The other thing that I found interesting is Bruce McLaren's involvement in Le Mans.
Yes.
This is a F1 podcast, but let's very briefly...
Oh no, we don't want
Yeah. Endurance racing. Well, that movie Ford versus Ferrari, I didn't realise that Bruce McLaren was the guy that stole... the win from
Ken Miles.
You have brought that up. Like, I keep forgetting his name. Ken Miles. Mm. Yeah. And denied Ken Miles the triple crown for the three endurance race wins in 1 year.
Yeah.
And it's Bruce McLaren who...
No one's ever done that as well since.
And he was so close, Ken Miles was. Yeah. And because there was that team order for them to both finish off...
But the technicality was... Ken Miles still crossed the line first, but back in those days, there wasn't a clear rule saying that whoever crossed the line first won. The rule was whoever went the furthest in 24 hours, and Bruce McLaren had started further back on the grid, and so it was determined that when he crossed the line second, because he'd started further back, he'd actually... covered more distance.
That's
and so
terrible. That's such a terrible rule.
I'm 90% sure that's what happened.
Yeah. Okay.
I know that Ford versus Ferrari kind of played with that with that fact a little bit to make it more dramatic. But
it is just funny to me that when I watched that, I didn't know much about McLaren or F1 at all, and now I look back and go, so he was the guy that really stole this. But you know, that's fine. He got to win Le Mans. So Bruce McLaren has won Le Mans, which is pretty cool.
1966.
Yeah, the famous year where Ford won it.
First of Ford's four victories at Le Mans.
Yeah. The other thing is, do you guys know Amon? Is it Chris Amon?
Chris Amon, yep.
Chris Amon.
Yeah, so he was the co-driver.
He was the co-driver, so they were very close, him and McLaren.
And he's another Kiwi as well.
He's another Kiwi, and so that's the thing, looking into Kiwi F1 drivers. But apparently, he is one of the best Formula 1 drivers that never won a race.
Amon? Yeah.
Yeah, 11 podiums with 96 starts. Mm-hmm. Fellow driver Mario Andretti once joked that if he became an undertaker, people would stop dying. Because that's how unlucky and bad it is. Well, you know, just...
That's a very good metaphor. Is that a metaphor?
Yeah. Something like that.
Something like that.
Could also be a hyperbole. Bit of an over-exaggeration.
Yeah, I guess so.
So, apparently they couldn't... Oh, let's see. That's actually all I have on Bruce McLaren.
Oh, okay. Well, that was a nice
I think that's all I have.
Do you know, I've just searched Bruce McLaren Museum, New Zealand... I think there's something at there's something at the Hampton Downs Motorsport Park. I reckon that would be so cool to go and check
out. Whereabouts, sorry?
Hampton Downs.
Hmm. That's probably where you grew up or something.
It could well be. I mean, it's a big motorsport park, so maybe they centered it there. But it's just sort of between Auckland and Hamilton. I mean, maybe that's all we've got. But I was thinking, surely with all this achievement, New Zealand must have a museum somewhere or some homage played to him, because it's pretty awesome.
It's pretty awesome. Yeah. Mm. No, I'd love to go there one day.
Didn't you tell me that the McLaren logo used to be a Kiwi bird?
There used to be a Kiwi bird on the McLaren logo.
That's mad.
Imagine.
Apparently that's what it used to be.
I would love if, you know, it stayed in the New Zealand kind of lineage and we could still have a Kiwi on the logo.
The unfortunate thing about it was that once he had died, it sort of became a new team in a way, but just kept the name.
Yeah.
And sure, the name has survived, which is great. But
it's iconic, though, now.
It is iconic.
Ferrari and McLaren are the two sort of OG teams that will never be forgotten.
For sure. Just going back to what you said earlier, he did actually win a race in Formula 1, so I was wrong on that one. So Yeah, he won.
Apology accepted.
The last, yeah, sorry for that. The last race he won was the 1968 Belgian Grand Prix, held at Spa-Francorchamps, which we still race at today. Obviously, a bit of a different track these days, but we do still race there. And yeah, he won in a McLaren Ford, and that was his last Grand Prix win. And Chris Amon was actually on pole position for Ferrari that day.
Mm.
But he didn't finish on the podium, I don't know.
That does remind me of the final thing that I learned, was that his death was actually super tragic, because he was just practicing, he was trialing.
He was testing his new car, wasn't he?
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah. But this was where the wings were starting to really get played with for more downforce on the car. But his was like real high up, which later was realised it was too dangerous. And so what it did was that as he was going, the back of his car lifted up. And
so it had too much drag, basically.
Something like that.
Because, yeah, I think I've seen a picture of it, like the angle of the wing was not like straight up, but it wasn't far off. So it was quite a steep angle.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that resistance and that drag must
have
caused
it. And he crashed straight into a Marshall's pole, which was scheduled to be removed, but didn't get removed for some reason.
So it was a Marshall's pole. Like, what is a Marshall's pole?
I'm not actually sure what a Marshall's pole is.
I wonder if it was like a Marshall post.
Post, where maybe a post. Sort
of, what, were they lean up against Wayne?
No, where they like where the marshals are stationed.
Oh, right.
A little, I don't know, a little hut almost.
And so what? So he just crashed into that, even though
instantly.
That was scheduled.
It was
to
meant
get
to
removed.
Be removed because it was gutting. Too dangerous to be there that's next gutting. To the race.
Oh,
and
wow.
Yet, if he crashed anywhere else, he would have probably, you know, just slid, kept sliding.
Done a Zhou Guan Yu and just slid.
Yeah, exactly.
The safety in motorsport was a lot different back then.
For sure. Anyway, with the, 15, 20 minutes we have left, is there anything else?
Well, no, that was awesome, Josh. Thank you for taking us through that.
Cheers.
I think we've got another cool section coming up now. Stephen, I'm going to throw this to you. Now, oh man, it was probably about four episodes ago. We teased it like we were gonna reveal Stephen's prior experience in interviewing people like Antonio Giovinazzi and numerous other pretty large names who historically have raced in Formula One. But we never got round to it. We somewhat forgot about it, so we're apologetic for that. But here he is now. Steve, you've interviewed a few cool people.
Yeah, I've interviewed a couple, so I think probably the best way to do this is to just explain it chronologically.
Yeah.
So the first interview that I ever got with a Formula One driver who at this point, so it was Jean-Éric Vergne who drove for Toro Rosso in the sort of the early 2010s. And at this point he'd lost his drive in F1 and was in Formula E. And essentially, I was in high school, and we had to write a profile on someone as part of my English class. And the idea was that you pick someone who you don't have to talk to them directly. You could, you know, you might pick a famous politician or something. And I thought, okay, well, I'm going to give this a go and say I'm writing this for my blog, and then double it as my English project. So I sent an email off to the media team at his Formula E team, and said, hey, I want to publish this on my blog. I want to talk to him, do an interview. And they said, yep. They organised it. I rang him while he was in between a flight. He was on the other side of the world. I got up at like 7 o'clock in the morning and rang through my through my home landline and put it on speaker and recorded with like an iPod so or something cool. to so I could listen back to it. And we talked about his career and sort of, because he'd lost his seat, I thought, in very unfortunate circumstances, where I thought, because it was a choice between whether he got promoted to Red Bull or Daniel Kvyat got promoted, and Daniel Kvyat got the nod in the end instead of Jean-Éric, even though he scored more points than Kvyat in his final season when they were teammates at Toro Rosso. So that was certainly a really cool experience, just to be able to talk to him directly, like literally over the phone. And then you mentioned as well, I've done Antonio Giovinazzi.
Just before we go to Giovinazzi, that was, you were what, 17 at the time when you interviewed him?
I would have been in year 12 at school, so I would have been 16 or 17.
What's that like from somebody who, because I know you've been a really intense Formula One fan since the age of about 14, What was that like? Like talking to somebody of some stature?
Yeah, it was one of those things when you first sent the email, you sort of thought, oh, you'll just send it and it won't work out. I remember they said when they gave his phone number to me, they said, look, here's his phone number, but it's on the condition that you call him for this and this only. I was like, okay, yes, it's fine.
So theoretically, you still have his phone number right now?
Buried in my email.
Oh, gosh. Yeah, that better
prank call. Let's go.
On the show.
On the show. New segment.
That would be not good. But, so that was, I mean, yeah, it was sort of, I remember I had, like, my questions all planned out, and I was really nervous as well. I remember, getting up really early.
Do you reckon that's probably one of the most nervous times you've been for an interview?
No.
No, okay.
Oh, right.
In my line of work, I work in journalism day to day, and, yeah, you do have to do some pretty gnarly things in journalism, so there's been some calls I've had to make there that, are pretty tough. But I guess it was, at the time it would have been pretty nerve-wracking. But you get into it, you get over it, you start talking and it all starts flowing.
And they're friendly.
Was friendly. Yeah. And I think they had probably clocked that it was, he wasn't talking to motorsport.com, so he could sort of be a bit more, a bit more frank and friendly and things, because it wasn't going to be picked up any wider.
But not long after that, you were interviewing Antonio Giovinazzi, who formerly raced for Alfa Romeo, then dropped out, was the test driver for Ferrari, and now is racing at IndyCar.
Yeah. No, he's racing in Formula E,
Formula
not
E,
IndyCar.
My bad.
He was driving for Alfa Romeo at the time, and I think it was, I want to say it was 2019, or it might have been 2020, I actually can't remember. But essentially, again, it was the same thing. I sent them off an email saying, hey, I want to write something for my blog. Here's my questions. Can we get some answers? And this one was a bit different, and I know that you don't like me bring this up, but instead of me getting to talk directly to Antonio, the easiest way they found it was to take my questions to him. They had one of the media department read the question out to him, and he answered it in an audio format, which was actually, that was top level of them to do that for me. They could have just given me written answers, but no, they got him recorded. So then I put a little podcast episode together by recording myself fake asking the questions and then putting his answer over. But I did say, I did disclose at the start that I'd done that for it. But I mean, to be able to ask questions of him was a pretty cool experience.
What was like one of the more interesting questions or answers that you got?
He said that they were targeting podiums that year, which
what do you mean by targeting podiums?
Like that was their target of what
they
wanted to achieve.
A podium.
They wanted
Alfa
to get a podium.
Romeo.
Yeah. Alfa Romeo.
How did you not laugh at that?
Yeah, well, I mean, that's why I published a story headlined with that, because I knew that was bold. It was a bold claim to make,
actually.
And as it turned out, it didn't happen, unfortunately, for them. But that was a cool one. But I think the one that sticks with me the most was, you guys won't know him, but there was a guy in the early 2000s called Jarno Trulli who raced in Formula 1.
I've heard of Jarno Trulli.
You've heard of Jarno Trulli? Jarno Trulli actually is one of the most experienced Formula 1 drivers of all time. He started 256 Grand Prix. He raced for lots of teams. He raced for Jordan, famous team, Renault, which was just before they got famous, drove for Toyota for many years, and then his career sort of ended in some minnow teams, unfortunately. But
was he like, so he wasn't like a Latifi, but he was,
he
what was he like,
to
a
me,
Ricardo?
Mm. To me, I always sum him up as a guy who was in the wrong place at the wrong time.
Hülkenberg,
so
maybe
changed. Hülkenberg would be a very good, yeah, very good, just a guy who never quite had a car that was good enough,
he wasn't quite good enough himself.
Well, no, I would push back on that and actually say, no, I think he had the talent, but he never quite executed the talent. He never quite executed properly. And the one thing about him, a lot of people remember him for a Trulli train, because he had this famous habit of being able to qualify. He was like a master qualifier, essentially. That was his forte. And so he would always qualify his car way higher than it was worth. Then he'd start the race and be way slower in the race, and everyone would get stuck behind him.
Yeah.
That's why it became a Trulli train. So it was quite funny. But yeah, one of the coolest things, I think, one of his coolest claims to fame was in the 2004 season, Michael Schumacher was dominant. He won, it was something like the first five or six races, and then Jarno beat him in Monaco, winning his only Grand Prix of his career, and then Michael went on to win the next seven or eight races.
Oh, wow.
Like,
far out.
I think Michael won the first 14 Or he, out of the first 14 races, he won 13 of them, and Yano won the other one.
So that's all interesting. May I just ask, Yano, how did we get onto Yano?
Oh, this one is great. Literally, I just found an email address for him. I sent him an email and said, hey...
Well, you just found his email address.
I found his email
that's
address.
That's crazy.
Cool.
And I said, hey, Yano, do you want to have a chat? I make this little podcast and I write this blog. He said, yep, let's do it. Within one day.
That's crazy.
It was amazing. It blew me away. Blew me away.
That's so cool.
It was so cool.
What did you ask him?
I just asked him about his career, basically. We went through his career, just got an overview of sort of things, high points, low moments. Told me about one low moment, which, I mean, it was already public knowledge, but he sort of talked about it again, where he was at Renault's home race, and this is what soured his relationship with Renault. He was at Renault's home race, and it was either on the last lap or the penultimate lap or near the end, he kind of got overtaken by a Ferrari. Like kind of just clumsily left the door open and the Ferrari went through, and big mistake basically at Renault's home race, and lost a double podium for them.
Is this home race just the French
Grand Prix? Yeah, it was back at a different track though, back in 2004 this was.
So this next French Grand Prix, is that going to be Alpine's home race still?
Yeah, technically that's Alpine's home race. Cool. French constructor, so yeah. Paul Ricard.
Very cool. I mean, those are some awesome stories.
I mean, being able to say I've talked to people who have driven in Formula One is a pretty cool thing.
That is really good. Do you intend on doing a few more in the future?
I do, but it takes, because as you know, I've got some success stories of people I've spoken to, but I've also got, you know, I've put requests in and never heard sort of thing.
Who snubbed you?
I know there was one time I wanted to talk to a driver about Formula One, and they were in Formula E, and the Formula E team said, look, you know, he's in Formula E, we don't want to do an interview focusing on Formula One. So
fair. Can you say who that was?
I don't want to say who it was, because I'm sure they probably won't listen, but if they do listen and hear me outing them. No, plus, in journalism we have a thing about off the record, and to me it was an off the record comment. Mm. So
fair enough. But no, very cool. No, thank you for sharing those. That's very good. I mean, we've got 10 minutes or so maybe we jump into some predictions for France.
Yeah. So obviously we'll just save our beat the boss for next time.
We might have to.
Yeah, we've got some good ones, but yeah, we'll just save it all for next time.
I think so. And I was thinking about the predictions. I think one thing that, as you've just heard, Stephen is very good when it comes to sort of general Formula One knowledge. You would have picked that up in the last few episodes. But the other thing you're really good at is you know tracks, and you know the sort of what cars and what teams do tracks favour. And I think we should start having you just interject our predictions with a little bit of knowledge on what teams are likely to perform better at the circuits. And that'll help Josh and I's knowledge grow, and also help our predictions be a bit better. So we have France coming up. What's the track like? Who do you think's going to do well?
Yeah, it's interesting because France, we have a few fewer years, I guess, of data, because it was only brought back onto the calendar recently. But there's a massive long straight in France, and it does tend to have higher speed sort of corners. There are also some low speed corners. But to me, it reminds me of a sort of Silverstone circuit, similar to Austria in some senses. Austria has those long straights and is key for a good engine. And that's why I wonder if Mercedes might continue, I guess, their form that we've seen in the last couple of rounds in France, because it's a similar sort of circuit to Britain and Austria, I guess, in that sense that it needs a car that has a decent engine. But then again, I guess Mercedes have done well in those races because they've been reliable. I guess they've also had pace, but ultimately I think it would be fair to say the Red Bull engine and the Ferrari engine are still faster on raw pace than the Mercedes engine. But you know, the Ferrari engine seems to be quite unreliable. So potentially that could be pushed to its limit again, I think, maybe in France. But I guess one interesting thing about France that I really wanted to bring up on sort of the predictions is in 2020, when we had the race there, it was one of the most boring races of the season. It really was.
Nothing happened.
There was no overtakes. It was really boring. 2021 was one of the best races, in my opinion, of the season, because it was the strategy battle between Verstappen and Hamilton. Do you guys remember France 2021?
Trying to throw my mind back.
It was similar to what happened in Austria in the race just gone, where One team went long, and so essentially one team pitted early and came out on the tyres, and then the other team went long and then pitted, and so they came out behind, but then they rapidly caught. And so it was this...
cat and mouse.
Mm. Yeah, the sort of the cat chasing. And mouse. So I can't remember which way it went round, actually, in France last time, but I think it was Verstappen caught Hamilton with a few laps to go and won the race, because they went for a three stop, I want to say, whereas Mercedes only stopped twice. Or it might have been Red Bull went for two stops and Mercedes only went for one. But Red Bull stopped an extra time, put on the fresh tyres, and the degradation was so high that they made the difference up of a lost pit stop.
Did you just search that up, Josh?
Yes. So yes.
Was it Verstappen that won that race, the French Grand Prix last year?
Yes. Yeah. And Hamilton second, Perez third.
I remember it was just such an exciting strategy battle because, Verstappen took that extra pit stop. They sacrificed the track position because Verstappen was behind Hamilton, right?
Yeah.
And Hamilton was going to win that race, and Red Bull had the gap to, okay, if we take another pit stop, we're still going to come out second, so we're not going to lose anything, but we'd give ourselves a chance to make the time back up from the lost pit stop and overtake Hamilton. And it worked a treat. It was an amazing strategy battle to watch. And the even better thing about it was that Mercedes had done the exact same thing to Red Bull a few rounds earlier in Spain 2021. So... I don't know. I wonder just with the tyres whether we might see something similar, or will it be like the 2020 race where it was boring as...
I'm going to say that Red Bull are going to be the best team at this one, because I have to say, when I saw some of the racing from Austria, it is so clear how much faster the Red Bull is than the Mercedes.
Oh, yeah, like that bit where Verstappen took Hamilton with so much ease.
Yeah, so easily. So the fact that Red Bull have such an advantage... and there's going to be long straights and everything. I reckon that Verstappen will come first and Perez will be on the podium as well.
Yeah,
that'll be my prediction.
One thing that's frustrated me this year is I haven't been able to find as much sort of coverage around the engines of each team. And I know early on it was talked about that Red Bull have the higher top line than Ferrari, which would suggest at a circuit like Paul Ricard, where there's that massive long straight, you know, potentially that will suit Red Bull. But then again, I mean, Paul Ricciardo also has slow corners and a couple of high speed corners. If Ferrari has the better chassis to get around the corners, it could be quite balanced, I think, is what I'm trying to say.
So what's your prediction, Steve?
I actually think, just given the momentum that Ferrari have shown in the last couple of rounds, I wonder if they're going to come to Paul Ricciardo and be on top. That's sort of my guess, I think.
Yeah. Good. Well, I mean, I think I'd be inclined to agree with you, Josh. I think it's more likely that Red Bull are going to come out on top. And yeah, I mean, interesting point with the momentum of Ferrari.
I just wonder if Charles Leclerc winning that last race in Austria, Ferrari were quicker than Red Bull on Sunday in Austria. They weren't on Saturday, but they were on Sunday. So,
Well, I'm going to apply the same sort of concept around Red Bull being fast. And I'm actually going to say, despite earlier on in this episode, we talked a lot about AlphaTauri and them being quite slow and off and out of the points as much as they were last season, I think we're going to see Gasly have his first, like, sort of decent race. I think he's French. It's sort of somewhat of a home Grand Prix for him. I think they've got the same engine as a Red Bull.
It is a home Grand Prix.
It is, yeah. So they've got the Honda engine, just like Red Bull do. So I think, theoretically, combining those two things, I think we're going to see Gasly finish definitely top 10. I'm not going to say top 6. I think he'll finish around, if he can finish that 7th or 8th mark, I think that's where my prediction kind of lies. I can't predict Yuki. He's just like a cannonball.
I'm going to predict that Daniel Ricciardo finishes outside the point.
Yes, I agree with that one.
Groundbreaking.
Great. Also, I'm going to add on that Alpine will get one of their cars in the top 6.
That would be cool. It would be nice to see. Hopefully Alonso, because he's had so much bad luck.
Well, because Ocon did he had his best finish this season, P5, in Austria, which we kind of forgot about.
Glossed over.
The thing, Alpine have just sort of been quiet achievers this year, don't you think? Like, when you've scored big results, they haven't been big on it, you know. They haven't been, oh my God, we're going to start winning races.
Yeah, but Lando is single-handedly keeping, like,
McLaren in it.
Yeah, it's crazy.
But I reckon with the home Grand Prix as well for Alpine, they'll get one of their cars in the top 6.
Awesome. Well, Lance, good luck if you're betting.
I'll try to bet for this one. All right, boys, good stuff.
It's been great. Another episode done. We're weekly now. which is a bit of news. So we're coming out every week.
Every week when there is a race.
When there's a race,
report.
Yeah.
Yeah. Unless we can get in here.
It'd be good to do one in the middle, I think, of the summer break.
Yes.
Because there'll be a four-week break coming up soon when Formula One goes on at summer
break.
Yeah,
so let's plan to do that. But coming to you weekly now when the racing is as chock-a-block as it is at the moment.
Yep.
And do check over at our Instagram, as we're always posting Formula One content over there. But yeah, it's been great, guys.
Cheers, guys. All right.
We'll see you next week.
See ya. Thanks for listening to 3Pre1Cast. If you want to catch up on any of our episodes, check us out on Plains FM, Apple Podcast, or Spotify.
Come and say hi to us on Instagram and TikTok at 3Pre1Cast.